This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. It's a journey that requires collaboration, curiosity, and communication among farmers, researchers, agronomists, consultants, and extension. You're going to hear their stories and discover how and why they're working together to make sense out of what's happening in the soil. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Soil Sense. I'm your host, Tim Hamrich. Today, Dr. Abby Wick and I wanted to bring more information to the podcast about this carbon markets and modeling thing that's happening and you're probably hearing about everywhere. So we identified a guest who's not only a CEO of a company doing that kind of work, but he also grew up on a farm that he's still involved in, worked in soil health with an agricultural co-op, and has a background in ag finance. So we thought he was uniquely qualified to help us explore how all of this carbon talk, so to speak, fits into soil health practice adoption, company involvement, and sustainability goals overall. So today, Abby and I are joined by Nick Ranke, CEO of Habitare. Nick hails from a family farm in North Dakota, where he's still actively involved, but his career took him off the farm, first into agricultural finance and insurance, then into ag tech. He was the soil health services lead for Truterra, which is owned by Land O'Lakes, before he took on this CEO role at Habitare last year. Habitare uses deep science and technology to quantify environmental outcomes for agriculture. But whereas many other companies focus just on trying to measure soil carbon, Nick says Habitare looks at things in a really comprehensive or systems-based context. They try to determine how environmental sustainability relates to real farming outcomes like productivity and nutrient management, and of course, soil health. Nick says what most excited him about this opportunity at Habitare was that he saw too many people focused on just soil carbon measurement and missing the picture of what that really means for these farm outcomes, and he thinks their approach can help. This is a really rich conversation here that builds on our recent episode with Dr. Jordan Wade. We talk more about measuring agricultural emissions and carbon sequestration, but we also take it a step further to discuss how addressing these topics can be integrated into a more comprehensive farm system that needs to make a profit at the end of the day to be truly sustainable. We'll kick off the conversation here where Nick is sharing more about his background before we dive into more about the work he's doing at Habitare.
So I grew up on a family farm back in North Dakota. Brother's still taking over that farm. Get back there and drive truck every harvest for those guys still. So corn, soybeans, wheat, beef cattle there. Then I spent about a decade in ag banking and crop insurance. Loved working with farmers, did that across the upper Midwest. But ultimately I saw everything coming in this kind of climate and sustainability space. And I just didn't hear a lot of authentic agricultural voices kind of carrying the message in that space at a system scale. So that's where I ended up taking a career pivot. Went to continue my education, Johns Hopkins, got an MBA there, and then I moved on to Truterra, the sustainability business at Land O'Lakes. So incredible experience at Truterra, really kind of an end-to-end value chain from a farmer-owned cooperative system, looking at how do we support farmers in the sustainability realm. During my time there, we launched actually a carbon market offering, so ended up ultimately transacting carbon credits with Microsoft. So for a farm boy from North Dakota, it was kind of incredible to get farmers paid by a world-leading technology company to have those farmers store carbon on behalf of that company, essentially in their soil. And it was just kind of an eye-opener as to what's possible in these new marketplaces to get, you know, additional resources to farmers and to just think differently about what does it mean to be in the farm economy. So my path to Habitare, what I recognized is current market approaches weren't very scalable, required a lot of data from farmers. Very difficult to quantify these outcomes accurately to support a scalable market to get farmers paid fairly for their outcomes. And that's what I met Dr. Kai-Yu Guan, the founder of Habitare. He's based out of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I saw something just fundamentally groundbreaking about the technology that he had developed. So a lot less dependency on manually gathered data and still generating really accurate outcomes. But again, getting back to that systems perspective, you know, not just looking at soil carbon, but let's think about this through the lens of the farmer. Like, you need to look at it from that full system. Like, how does this relate to inputs? How does it impact productivity? Things like that. So that's where I've been really excited to kind of join this scaling team here.
Very cool. And so maybe give more detail to the offering itself. Is it a satellite-based data collection process, or what's that look like?
Yeah, it's really data from a lot of different sources. So satellites are absolutely one component of that. But I think there's appropriate caution applied to anything that is like a satellite-based solution, if that's the only thing that they're doing, because remote sensing or satellite data, it does certain things very well, and there's a lot of things that it doesn't do so well, right? So for us, it's really kind of a system of systems approach. So we've got that satellite data for one component, both thinking about, you know, looking at what the farming practices were, but then there are a whole lot of other data layers that we pull together. So we can use satellite data to get an accurate idea of, you know, what's happening from like a photosynthetic productivity standpoint at a field level, but you need to combine that with soil data and, you know, topography data and weather data and all those other things that really heavily influence the ultimate outcome. So we're pulling data from numerous sources that way too, looking at the underlying soil characteristics. And we can also get simple things like even, you know, a picture with your smartphone can be geotagged and uploaded, and that can serve as sort of a ground truth for what's happening for biomass and ground cover and that kind of thing. And then we upscale that, ultimately thinking about quantification across millions of acres instead of just a single field.
Are you targeting farmers with this? And what's the customer experience look like from what's the problem they're facing that they're going to, you know, the light bulb's going to come on, they say, I need something like this, to how it actually plays out?
Yeah. So the farmer is a really critical stakeholder for us, but ultimately I wouldn't necessarily say the farmer is the customer, right? And what I mean by that is I think farmers have been inundated with different sources of ag technology and that kind of thing. And the value proposition is, you know, not always super clear. And philosophically, I don't think the farmers are the ones that should be paying for this type of information anyway. So for us, the customer, the ones that are paying the bills, are the corporations that have climate targets, right? So this is a company that's sourcing from the world of agriculture, or maybe a company that's trying to generate carbon credits. But one thing that's kind of unique for us, in a lot of those markets, it's a truly one-way data flow. Farmers report all of this data to engage with the carbon market, and it just kind of goes downstream for the quantification side of things, but there isn't a feedback loop that creates any additional value for the farmer. So a really good case study for us is work that we're doing with the National Association of Conservation Districts. That's a mouthful, NACD. So 3,000, you know, local conservation districts spread out throughout the country. We kind of know conservation happens locally, right? So you need those local influences to support farmers. And what we're doing with NACD is part of the USDA Climate Smart Commodities funding that there was a lot of news about last year. So that's a project that we did a pilot on last year, and now that's going to go live for the next 5 years, scaling up. And two components of that project. One, it's saying, you know, was that USDA funding effective in supporting climate smart agriculture? So that's kind of that aggregated quantification on what I'd call the downstream side. But a really critical part of this work is farm field level insights back to the farmers that are participating, saying based on your specific field, right, your cropping history, your specific soil types, rotation, management practices, all of that, you know, how has it gone over the past few years? But we're also scenario modeling into the future. So everybody's telling you to adopt a cover crop or reduce tillage or reduce fertilizer application. We can actually forward model that and say, again, specific to your individual field and your own history, you know, what are the impacts that might arise out of changing practices as kind of this whole market is pushing for. So that's where it's kind of that bi-directional, right? So there is that feedback loop to farmers, that it's actual engagement. And ideally, this grows into decision support for farm advisors and farmers as they think about changing practices.
And how is that different than what a crop consultant or agronomist might do for a farmer? Or is it different?
To me, we're just a value-added tool, right? So this is one more tool in the toolkit. So we're under no illusions that this technology is going to actually drive change in and of itself. But it's a tool that an agronomist or an advisor can use to help kind of demystify this conversation or make these insights feel more relevant to the individual farmers that they're working with. So for us, the position is like, we don't have any idea that we're going to be a market mover, a market changer on our own. It's really that as a supporting technology, one, we can reduce the data burden from farmers, which is a big one. So if they want to enroll in one of these programs, instead of reporting 40 data points, maybe it's only 10, right, that they have to actually report on. But then in the hands of advisors, now it's just one more tool. So an advisor kind of like I said, they already know all the practices that they're recommending. The advisors are going to know what works best in that area, but it's one more tool to actually visualize and tie it back to that individual farmer in a specific field scenario. And I could see advisors experimenting with this on their own and saying, you know, here are the recommendations I've been making. Maybe it can even build confidence for the advisors in terms of their recommendations as tied to a certain soil type or something like that. Maybe there might be some novel insights that can be generated where, you know, no advisor is going to be able to know every possible interaction with every farming scenario or soil type. So again, I'm not going to pretend like we have all the answers either, but it's another source of insights and just another lens to look through.
I was going to ask, a farmer asked me this the other weekend about, they didn't quite understand scope 3 emissions and what all this carbon market stuff is. And so since you have a farming background, can you explain that in farmer talk as to what scope 3 is and why we're doing all these things that we're doing?
Yeah, love that question. It's difficult because all this stuff gets kind of lumped into that carbon market conversation, right? And it's what do these different things mean? So scope 3 is actually what I'm most excited about because now we're attaching these outcomes to the actual ag value chain. So the difference between scope 3 and like carbon market in the more general sense is this is would be where your grain's actually ending up. One thing that's challenging in agriculture today is for most farmers, I know they're hauling it to the local aggregation facility, the local grain elevator, and there's no real attachment to the ultimate end use of that grain in most cases, right? So that's one of the challenges, I think, in just kind of connecting the mental dots here. But scope 3, all that really means is for one of these corporations, when they set their big climate targets, right, they've got three main scopes of emissions. So scope 1 is going to be within their individual operations, so their owned facilities and things like that. Scope 2 is going to be their energy sourcing, so where they're getting their power. And then scope 3 is going to be everything that goes into their product. So everything upstream in terms of all the different inputs. So when they talk about scope 3 emissions and those companies needing to reach their targets, if they're trying to reduce corporate emissions by 40 or 50% or something like that, agriculture is the single largest share of their overall emissions in a lot of cases. So that's where these companies are looking to work with the farmers who are ultimately supplying one of their major inputs and help those farmers help them reduce their emissions towards those corporate targets. So it's been exciting to see various companies that are starting to invest meaningfully in this, but that hopefully is a reasonably basic distillation of scope 3.
It's great because I don't fully understand it either, but I can understand now why the companies are so invested in, you know, helping farmers adopt sustainable practices and why that's meaningful to them.
And to that end, you know, if a company, you know, they want to reduce their scope 3, so they want to work with farmers, you know, what would be the gap that they're trying to fill that they might come to you all at Habitare and say, we want to use your tool? Like, what would drive them to that?
Yeah, probably worth talking about kind of the basic journey that these companies go on when they set these goals, right? So they don't have any very good data on this. So when they go out to set these goals, they might be able to get some public emissions factor would be the term where, you know, say a bushel of corn in the United States has a certain amount of emissions associated with it on average, and this is some public data that they can go and pull from. So then it's a very simple calculation of how many bushels of corn did we buy times that emissions factor. But you both know, and this whole audience knows, not every bushel of corn, not every corn field is created equal, incredibly variable from one field to the next and that kind of thing. So what they run into is, great, we use that information to set a goal, but how the heck do we even begin to track our progress? You know, you deliver a load of corn to the elevator, you're not saying how you raise that corn or anything like that. So there's no data that goes down the supply chain for these companies to actually understand, you know, what happened in that field. So they quickly move to needing better data for what they're gathering. But then if they want to make progress towards the goals, that's where they get to investing in farmers, supporting farmers in practice change, trying to influence that however they can. And ultimately, then you need the associated data to say, okay, we maybe influenced some practice change here. Now, what was the change that resulted from that practice change that we influenced? So, you know, they can set the target without any high quality or regionally specific data. But as soon as they want to start tracking towards these targets, like a lot of them have 2030 targets, right? So by 2030, they're going to reduce emissions by a certain percentage. Well, if you're going to track progress, you're going to need a lot better data. And that's just logistically and cost prohibitive. It's very difficult for them to get. So we're trying to streamline that process. And the big thing that I don't want to lose there is streamlining that process means more of these resources go to farmers. So if these companies have to staff up or go out and manually collect the data or whatever, that's really cost intensive. And every penny spent on quantifying is a penny not spent supporting farmers and advisors and people like that. So if we make that quantification piece more efficient, that's more resources to farmers.
Okay, yeah, that's an interesting angle. And that's alongside the point you made earlier, which is that it's not just about carbon levels, right? Like, it's about more of this holistic system of what does sustainability mean? If we focus too much on one variable, even though it's carbon, and that's the big variable everybody wants to talk to right now, we're going to kind of miss the point. Am I tracking?
Yeah, spot on. I will try to resist the temptation to go too deep into the weeds on this, but an important thing to note is these companies with emissions targets, there are incredibly complex like accounting guidelines and stuff like that that they face. And I think it's worth noting the difference between something like soil carbon and something like nitrous oxide emissions from fertilizer application, right? So the reason that I call this out is one of the things that I hear from farmers as they're looking at these environmental markets. Well, how do you expect me to sign up for such a long-term commitment? Or you're expecting me to stick to these practices for a long time? Well, what's influencing that is the soil carbon piece specifically. So these companies, when they account for this, they account for emissions reductions on one side of things and emissions removals on the other side. So you think about carbon storage in the soil, that's a removal. You're removing it from the atmosphere, putting it into the soil. But we know that that soil carbon process is dynamic. So it's a flux. So you're gaining and losing soil carbon every year is the reality of it. But that company, if they're going to put that into their sustainability claim or their goal, now that company, actually, that's kind of a liability for them long term, right? So if one of the farmers that they work with stores some carbon for a few years and then practices change, farmer goes and needs to till it all up because of weather or whatever the case might be, they've re-released that carbon. So now that company that made that claim has to make an accounting adjustment where that claim actually reversed. And that's why I say it's so important to look at things like nitrous oxide, because the day that you avoided that emission, right, if you reduce that emission, you avoided it, there's no legacy impact. There's no tail to that. There's no liability. Like in 2023, if I reduced fertilizer application or, you know, did a better job with fertilizer, reduced nitrous oxide, there's no long-term commitment to prove that that stayed reduced because you just didn't emit it in the first place. So that's another important thing to understand. And one of the things that makes me so passionate about the complete picture is nitrous oxide and those sources of emissions. They're every bit as large and impactful and arguably even more impactful from a climate standpoint in the near term. But everybody's focused on soil carbon, and it's clearly problematic to manage that in the world of agriculture if you're expecting that to just get stored and stay stored forever.
Do you think that comes from like measurement aspects, that it's just easier to focus on carbon and measure carbon versus like nitrous oxide and other approaches? Or is it a measurement thing, or is it just everybody's thought of carbon for so long that it's just easier?
Yeah, that's a fun question too. I don't know. These are all fun questions. I get too excited about this stuff. So really there are a few things that I think drive that, Abby. So, you know, number one would be this overall context around like carbon credits. So you think about the initial buyers of carbon credits, it's really attractive to think that we can undo legacy emissions. And I think this is another thing that, you know, farmers rightfully question is, if I'm storing carbon, if I'm removing carbon from the atmosphere for some company, does that mean they just get to keep polluting, right? So I'm a good actor, they're a bad actor, and it all washes out. So what's the point? And unfortunately, there might be a little bit of truth to that, that, you know, it is an attractive solution because you're not really having to change your operations if you can store carbon as opposed to reducing emissions, because that can get hard and expensive sometimes. So I think that's one layer. To the other layer on measurement, I'm sure you know very well, Abby, that measuring soil carbon is not easy by any means, right? It's a tiny, tiny signal. You know, if you change soil carbon sequestration, it's maybe like 2 parts per thousand of the whole system, right? So it's just really, really difficult to measure year to year. So it's certainly not because it's easy to measure, but relatively speaking, it might be easier to measure than nitrous oxide, truthfully, right? Because if you're measuring nitrous oxide, that is just a whole different plant process. And again, that's where I think it's interesting that technologies like ours are coming online, that are now making it possible. So the market has taken off down this path of soil carbon, really important. Let's keep that important. But there's maybe alternatives that are more aligned with what a farmer's trying to accomplish, like more efficient production. So can I produce as much with less fertilizer or better application of that fertilizer? And can somebody incentivize me to make it a little bit worth, more worth making two or three passes instead of one in the fall, right? And that's where I see real potential. So, you know, not an easy answer for that, unfortunately. I think there are a lot of layers that have pushed us down the carbon path, but I see a ton of opportunity looking at the more comprehensive picture.
What was the kind of original insight or the unique insight that Dr. Caillou had that kind of led to this? Because you're talking about sort of getting your arms around everything, which is a tough challenge. So there had to have been something where he looked at something different that enabled this, I would imagine.
Yeah. Again, trying not to go too deep into the science weeds on this. Some of the other models that are out there are ways of quantifying these changes to production systems and ultimately changes to soil carbon. These things are called biogeochemical models. So combining all those different components of the system. And most of them have been built based around looking at the soil. So just focusing on soil science. So what you run into with those models is you need to go out and you need to get a really accurate measurement of soil carbon sort of as beginning and end points. And you have all these data needs for calibration of the models. And it's just not a very scalable way to look at it. And those were also designed 30 plus years ago before we had all these modern remote sensing technologies and all these modern ways of looking at production systems. So Caillou took a fresh look at it. And, you know, when he started pulling the system together, he said, again, back to like, what does modern technology do well? One of the things it does well is we can look at above ground plant growth processes. So that doesn't help you that much in a soil model, but that helps you a ton if you're looking at a comprehensive system model. Because now when we think about the system, the only input of carbon is photosynthesis. So if we can accurately estimate photosynthetic activity, we now know the entire input to that equation. And if we can get yield, that is the biggest offtake of carbon from the field. The grain leaving the field is the biggest loss of carbon from the system. And then you've got plant respiration and soil respiration, which are the other parts of the cycle, which are highly correlated with those other things that I just mentioned. So now your remainder is soil carbon. So it was really flipping the problem on its head in the context of new technology that makes this sort of mass balance calculation approach even possible in a way that it just hasn't historically been before these technologies were available.
I feel like there's a lot of pressure on farmers with this idea to feed the world, right? So they need to bump up their production, but now they might reduce their production because they might adopt some soil health practices in the short term. I don't believe that that's a long-term response. I think they can, you know, bring those yields back up, but I feel like it's just a lot of pressure on farmers to save everything. And I think I said that at the Green Biz meeting, I told the whole audience, I was like, you're asking farmers to do all of these massive things for the world. And if you were looking at like a first step or, you know, way that maybe talk about your family farm as to they reduce tillage first, right? Is that kind of where they started or were they, you know, have they incorporated cover crops? Can we break this down into steps for what people could do? And now yeah. I'm asking you to be a soil health expert. So
no, I love
I'm looking for ideas.
Yeah. The hesitation I have, and again, I'm certain that I'm preaching to a much better educated choir than myself, but it's that all these things happen in concert, right? Like they're all interrelated. So it needs to be that systems approach. So sure, you could play with reductions in tillage, right? But what is the interplay between tillage and keeping living roots in the system? So cover cropping. And then what's the interplay between those two things and fertilizer and nutrient management? And now you even get into like crop rotation, which we haven't even touched on yet. And as you know, like they all influence each other. So I would argue that in most cases, I don't think it's the best thing to even try to pick one singular practice to isolate and experiment with, because you might not see the full benefit to the system that you would otherwise with a combination of practices. But yeah, exactly like you said, it's tough to know. And that's where we need people giving advice locally who really understand what might work on a local basis. But, you know, back to what farmers do already, I don't think anybody is, nor should anybody be asking them to flip the whole farm in the same year, right? Like farmers are experimenting all the time with different varieties and different approaches on different fields. So, you know, pick some land, especially some marginal land, right? Like pick some land that hasn't performed very well for you. Use that as your playground a little bit, and maybe don't flip the whole farm, but pick a field or two to work with. So that's one of the places that I argue for.
I like that. Those sound all like very tangible things a farmer can do, you know, to maybe meet some of these needs for the carbon markets or for greenhouse gas reductions, but they're things they can actually visualize and do. Can we tap into your financial background also? And maybe this is kind of a nugget for people who don't have experience on a farm, don't know about farm loans, what that looks like, the risk that's associated there, what a banker may allow you to do and may not allow you to do. What does changing something on a farm operation look like from that perspective of loans, finances, practices, labor? How complicated is it?
You know, as long as your forecast looks good, bankers are usually going to be happy, right? But we just talked about how changing practices does create risk for at least a near-term reduction in yield. And that's where it gets pretty tough, right? If I go into my banker who's approving an operating line for me every year, looking at an individual annual basis, and then I've got this Nick guy who's telling me that I should go out there and adopt regenerative practices. And he says after, you know, 3 to 5 years, it'll get worse for a little bit there, but then it'll get better after 3 to 5 years from now. There aren't many bankers that are signing up to take that ride, right? Like that's just not how the whole system is structured. It's structured to be an annual financial system. So it just doesn't pair well with practices that take a little bit longer to show that true benefit. So that's a huge struggle. I've talked to some people that are kind of in the back end of these financial systems, and there have been some cool things that have been done for like organic agriculture transition loans, right? That's a pretty straightforward case where you go 3 years, you get certified organic, and now you've got a premium. So you kind of have that clear sort of actuarial or financial case for it being worth the risk. Regenerative agriculture is hard that way because it just depends, right? There is no perfect, in exactly 3 years, the whole system is going to work great, right? Like that's just not how it works. So that is a major struggle. I'll say one comment that I would make broadly, both about financial risk and for farmers. I liked your comment earlier, Abby, about how much we're asking farmers to do, like feed everybody and save the planet, you know, maybe raise a family and that kind of thing if you got time. But what we see coming, and farmers are seeing this already, like we're seeing more extreme weather events. So more extreme rainfall, broader drought, things like that. Like farmers are starting to, I think, see this, and that those are real effects of climate change. And we know that better soil management results in more resilient production systems. So there's near-term yield risk, right? And I think long-term yield, at least improvements or efficiency improvements. But the real prize there to me is actually the resiliency piece. So, you know, are we going to maximize top line yield right away? Maybe not. But if all the science is telling us we should expect these extreme weather events to get worse, then I want to build a system that's going to be resilient. It's going to be there for my kids, or I guess in this case, my brother's kids, to take over, even though we know it's going to get harder over the years to come.
Well, a really interesting conversation there with Nick. I mean, we almost never feature CEOs of private companies here on the show, but I thought he did a great job of covering both the aspirational side of their approach, but also the practical side from his farming background as well. If you'd like to learn more about what they're doing, you can go check out their website, which is just habiterre.com, H-A-B-I-T-E-R-R-E. Thank you to our sponsors of this season of Soil Sense, the North Central Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, the North Dakota Corn Council, the North Dakota Wheat Commission, the North Dakota Soybean Council, the North Harvest Dry Bean Association, the North Dakota Barley Council, and Anheuser-Busch. If you're getting value from these podcasts at all, we'd love it if you'd leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or both, and share your favorite episodes on social media using the hashtag SoilSense. We'll be back with more great soil health content in a couple days.